John Talansky is co-principal percussionist of the Royal Opera House Orchestra and has performed with all of the great English orchestras and under many of the outstanding conductors of our time. Interested in historic performance style, he became interested in the preservation of old recordings as well. When the Performance Research and Conservation Committee was established in Great Britain in 1985, Mr. Talansky became its secretary, and he wished to make a presentation to us on this committee. Unfortunately, at the last minute, he also was not able to attend, but he sent a tape recording in which he reads his paper, and it runs about 18 minutes. So, all the way from London, John Talansky.
Since the 1890s, composers, performing artists, students, and music lovers have been able to hear the recorded interpretations of a great number of the world's musical executants. Thomas Edison's invention of 1877, which he called the phonograph, led to the growth of a recording industry which was destined to exert strong influences on the artistic and financial fortunes of the music performing profession. During the present century, most of the world's eminent performers have recorded interpretations for the gramophone at some juncture in their career. These commercially produced recordings have been heard all over the world, and in many instances, their fame has created a climate for artistic influence and development, particularly in areas of orchestral and operatic performance. The role of the performer as interpreter and international musical messenger has become increasingly exposed through the availability of comparative recorded reference material. Holdings of public archives, such as the National Sound Archive of Great Britain and the Rodgers and Hammerstein Sound Archives in New York, illustrate significant developments in performance style and technique during the last century, and this superb legacy of commercially produced recordings from cylinders to compact discs provides great performance research potential for performers, students, scholars, and the general public. Although these recordings have been approved for distribution by performers, they are only partially representative of the actual quantity of recorded reference material which exists in various places. Not long after Edison's initial experiments had taken place, individuals began to make private and often clandestine recordings of performances. Early examples of this practice took place in New York between 1900 and 1904, when Lionel Mapleson recorded fragmentary extracts of many of the performances taking place at the Metropolitan Opera. Although these recordings were unauthorized in origin, they subsequently assumed considerable historic importance as cameos of artists such as the Deresque brothers and Mancinelli, an assistant conductor of Verdi, who never made commercial recordings. Other maple cylinders preserve performers including Calvé, Melba, and Semblish, interpreting works they never recorded commercially. Furthermore, these recordings reveal singers, full orchestra, and conductor performing in live theater conditions. And, despite serious technical limitations of recording balance and frequency, a genuine glimpse of contemporary performance styles in a real performing environment has been preserved by Mapleson. More than 80 years later, the quantity of such privately made, unauthorized recordings in existence is enormous. Acetate recordings of radio broadcasts began to be made in the 1930s. And in the 1950s, the domestic tape recorder enabled far more people to record concerts and opera performances from radio relays and sometimes even on location. The advent of the cassette recorder in the 1960s multiplied this activity considerably, especially on location. A very large and unsanctioned domain of recorded performances now exists, without legal or physical protection, and many of these items contain performing and interpretative characteristics which are sometimes not present on commercial recordings. This alternative area of existing on official recordings is both culturally priceless and ethically dangerous, since the potential for illegal and unpermitted commercial exploitation is high. Indeed, although many of these recordings have only been made genuinely for reference purposes, sometimes they have been illegally copied and distributed as pirated goods. The Performance Research and Conservation Committee consists of representatives of composers, performers, unions, rights organizations, and the performing, recording, and broadcasting industries in the United Kingdom. It has been formed for several reasons, one of which is to tackle the highly sensitive and complex legal and ethical issues which are at stake if existing privately made recordings are to be preserved safely for research. It is not possible to discuss in detail here the many moral and legal questions of protection of rights which must be carefully and thoroughly examined before illicitly made recordings from the past might be considered suitable for research in a controlled environment. However, the committee recognizes the importance of creating regulated conditions for the conservation of future performances in concert halls and opera houses, and would like to establish an international central archiving network for this purpose. This organization would represent the rights of all properly interested parties in archive recordings, the copyright of which would be exclusively and solely vested with this body. Guarantees of rights for composers and performers would be entered into with provisions for consents and refusals. Such officially agreed and properly safeguarded recordings could initially be deposited in major public archives, such as the British Library National Sound Archive, where they would reside alongside commercial recordings and recordings of radio broadcasts previously taken officially by that archive. An international computer catalogue would enable worldwide reference contact to be made in accredited archives. Negotiations might be considered for strictly limited listening use of these recordings to accompany performance research and lectures at individually selected performing and educational venues where artists could discuss their interpretations with musicologists. The new organization would safeguard the rights on recordings from any unpermitted exploitation, which would contravene the Performers Protection Act and consequently be subject to prosecution, as would any other illegal recording activity. If these plans materialize, a greater comprehensive bank of recorded reference material will exist for musical study, and a regulated and controlled system of conservation will better protect the rights of artists, employers, and the community. However, there remains the perplexing and highly complex issue of finding means to authorize research for recordings which have originated outside agreements. Although some public sound archives have arrangements to house recordings of broadcasts they themselves register, musicians and the public have no agreed listening access to a plethora of archive recordings which exist in radio and television stations, private collections, concert halls, opera houses, trusts, and even the vaults of recording company archives. Although artists have not approved these recordings, frequently, the material is of great documentary and artistic value, and particularly in the case of recordings held by private individuals, their physical and legal safety is not assured. I will now list a few examples of the research potential of archive recordings which underline the vital need to find systematic methods of preserving such material with similar safeguards to the protection intended for future archive recordings. The unique importance of these documents can be classified into three general categories: performances given by identical artists in different conditions from those same performers' studio recordings, performances given by artists who have not commercially recorded their interpretations, and recordings featuring combinations of artists who have not collectively recorded their interpretations in the studio. A striking example of the first category is a recording which exists of a radio broadcast of the opera Village Romeo and Juliet by Delius. The entire vocal cast, Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and conductor Sir Thomas Beecham performed this work continuously in the BBC's Maida Vale studios only a few days before commercially recording the opera for EMI in 1948. Yet the performance of the Walk to the Paradise Garden intermezzo from the last act is hardly recognizable as an interpretation from the same artists. In the commercial recording, Beecham observes the lento crotchet 54 marking at the outset, and the performance proceeds sensitively but in a fairly straightforward manner, with the famous Royal Philharmonic Orchestra wind players giving a typically flexible, poetic, yet precise account of the solos. The atmosphere is one of resigned peace at imminent death in loving communion. But on the radio broadcast, conductor and orchestra behaved very differently. The lento is extraordinarily slow, yet wonderfully sustained at 44 crotchets, and the hushed entry of the violins and violas at figure A is followed by an intensely expressive accented piano diminuendo in the cello's first theme, which is played tenuto with great intensity, yet at a barely audible pianissimo. The oboe, cor anglais, and later bassoons and clarinets are anguished in their delayed rubato entries, which slowly crescendo in a much longer and more strenuous time span than they encompass on the commercial recording. The atmosphere is wrapped with unearthly beauty and longing. The entire interlude is viewed as an almost unbearable farewell to life, with emotively held back entries and an enraptured espressivo sonority absent on the commercial recording. Furthermore, the ensemble and intonation in this extraordinary reading are impeccable. From the second category of recordings, a fine example is a performance of Pelléas et Mélisande of Debussy, given in Lyon in 1981. The soprano Colette Alliot-Lugard has not commercially recorded her interpretation of Mélisande, and an archive recording is at present the sole witness to a ravishing performance of vocal beauty and consummate French singing style. Furthermore, the elusive character of Mélisande seems to have been mysteriously reincarnated in an interpretation of haunting sensitivity, delivered with the kind of legato and suppleness which Debussy spoke of in his early comments on the work's composition. From the third category, a recording of the now famous performance of Verdi's Otello at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden in 1980, not only preserves the inspired and virtuoso execution from the orchestra and conductor, Carlos Kleiber, but also allows a hearing of Placido Domingo interpreting his famous portrayal of Otello under the direction of a different conductor from his commercial recording of 1978. A particularly interesting comparison is the tempo for the great Act III monologue, Dio mio potevi, in which Kleiber requests that Verdi's exact tempo markings are observed. This means that the monologue itself proceeds at adagio 66 crotchets, precisely half the tempo of the 132 crotchets indicated for the preceding orchestral outburst, where Otello forces Desdemona out of his room. At this speed, faster than is usually adopted, the phrasing of singer and orchestra here depicts a distraught rather than traditionally desperate Otello, sung voce soffocata, with the moment of true hopelessness arriving later at the words ma o pianto o duol, sung con voce. On Domingo's excellent commercial recording conducted by James Levine, the tempo is conventionally slower and the character of the monologue brooding and desolate. Carlos Kleiber's outstanding interpretation has not been commercially recorded, and this archive recording is a unique surviving memory of this charismatic conductor's imaginative and masterly direction of Otello at Covent Garden. A final example, also from the third category, raises an interesting issue. a recording of the electrifying concert at the Royal Festival Hall, London, in 1965, in which Igor Stravinsky conducted the new Philharmonia Orchestra in his Firebird Suite, features an introduction greatly different in tempo, phrasing, and dynamic markings from the composer's commercial recording made in America in 1959. The concert performance opens atmospherically with a magical piano and a steadier tempo than the commercial recording, which was Stravinsky's third of this work, in which the composer interpolates accents in the sinister trombone chords. Here the composer takes a different view of his own work in an alternative environment, but within a relatively short distance of time. These very few examples show how archive recordings of public performances can illustrate local variations in style and interpretation which identical artists exhibit in differing environments and on diverse occasions. They also underline the need to conserve interpretations not commercially recorded, either individually or collectively. Further examples of commercially unrecorded interpretations by Beecham, Edish Kleiber, Furtwängler, and scores of other artists abound in private collections. The true worth of all recordings for performance research can only be evaluated if such unauditioned archive recordings are properly protected and safely preserved alongside officially approved commercial recordings. The latter alone already provide a magnificent legacy of study. Illustrated performance research can give us the opportunity to hear the general and individual sounds, techniques, styles, traditions, and habits of singers, orchestras, conductors, and instrumentalists in geographically and historically comparative circumstances, which have changed radically in many ways during this century, especially since the 1940s. The vast quantity of alternative archive recordings which exist in so many various places will neither enlighten nor inspire society unless genuine legal protection can be found for their conservation for research. A central archiving organization needs to acquire full protective rights in this material to enable it to be safeguarded with future conservation for study. Without safe custodianship, these unique recordings are vulnerable to physical deterioration and illegal plunder. Proper legal protection is needed to enable artists, performing venues, archives, broadcasters, and the general public to have research access to conserved performances. The printed score alone is only a partial guide to the understanding of composition and interpretation. Beethoven, Mahler, Rachmaninoff, and Stravinsky, amongst many other composers, changed details in orchestral parts after hearing their works performed in different ways and environments. Many details of sonority, rhythm, balance, inflection, and phrasing may not be properly indicated in notation before performance. The performer's role in the recreation of a composer's vision is one of physical reality and changing feelings in the eternal quest to convey the original creation to the public. Musical art tells the truth with magic, and that spell of sound is cast over humanity by the performer. In a democratic society, reconsideration is an essential component of understanding, and spontaneity can inspire new sensations and ideas. The transient performance of music in public environments deserves to be conserved alongside the commercial artifact of studio representation. Hopefully, artists will continue to record their interpretations in studios, and the music profession will also acknowledge the need to create a foolproof and protective legal system to conserve the world's performance heritage, future and past, for all music-loving persons.